On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I don't think there's ever been someone so qualified to hold this office. She's got the courage, the compassion, and the heart to get the job done. And I say that as somebody who had to debate her more than 20 times. Even after our own hard-fought campaign, in a testament to her character, she agreed to serve our country as Secretary of State. And from the decision we made in the Situation Room to get bin Laden, to our pursuit of diplomacy in capitals around the world, I have seen her judgment. I've seen her toughness. I've seen her commitment to our values up close. I've seen her determination to give every American a fair shot at opportunity, no matter how tough the fight was. That's what has always driven her, and it still does. So I want those of you who've been with me from the beginning of this incredible journey to be the first to know that I'm with her. I am fired up, and I cannot wait to get out there and campaign for Hillary.
President Obama endorsing Hillary Clinton in a video made Tuesday but released today by the White House. The president met earlier today with Bernie Sanders. Sanders later said he would continue his campaign into the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia in July, and he said this.
I look forward to the full counting of the votes in California, which I suspect will show a much closer vote than the current vote tally.
Yes, millions of Californians voted in the primary election, but we still don't know just how many millions or who all those people voted for. There are still about 500,000 uncounted ballots here in LA County alone. The guy in charge of counting all those ballots, Dean Logan. He's the Los Angeles County Registrar, Recorder, and County Clerk, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to talk with you.
You must be pretty busy counting all those ballots.
It's a busy time, and that's what we plan for, and that's what we're used to. So, lots going on here.
So L.A. County, 500,000 ballots yet to be counted. Why so many, and which ballots are they?
So first, just to put that in context, in California, it is not unusual at all for up to a third of the votes cast in an election to be counted after Election Day, and those fall into a couple of different categories. So here in L.A. County, those are primarily vote-by-mail ballots that either were turned in at polling places on Election Day or that have been received timely in the mail through Election Day, as well as provisional ballots that are cast on Election Day. So about 570,000 is our current estimate. About 240,000 of those are provisional ballots that were cast at polling locations where we will need to go and validate the eligibility of the voter, address whatever issue caused the provisional ballot, and then count those. Typically, about 85 to 90% of those are found to be eligible ballots that are ultimately counted. We received about 125,000 vote-by-mail ballots where the voter walked those in and turned it in at a polling place on Election Day. Another 205,000 that were received through the mail on Election Day. And then, of course, we have a new law in California that allows for ballots that are postmarked on Election Day but received within 3 days of the election to be counted. So today's mail and tomorrow's mail will still include ballots that we will ultimately add to the totals in this election.
And for the entire state, I've seen an estimate of 3 million ballots yet to be counted. Does that sound right?
You know, I have been focused on L.A. County, but given the statistics statewide, that does not surprise me because, again, in the northern part of the state, the percentage of voters who vote by mail is even higher. So that doesn't surprise me that they're still dealing with a lot of vote-by-mail ballots that either came in on Election Day or during this three-day period.
There were a lot of tweets and social media posts yesterday where people were complaining about problems when they went to go vote. Either they weren't on the voting rolls or the machines were broken. What kinds of irregularities have you seen?
Well, I think a lot of this relates to, and I am very sympathetic to those issues, and I take those issues very seriously. The primary process, and particularly the presidential primary process in California, is, and just candidly from my perspective, is overly complicated and was not designed with the voter in mind. It's a process that's not like any other election. Voters have to vote a specific party ballot. The parties have different rules that determine who can and who cannot participate in their primary. Add to that the surge of new registrations that we had leading up to this election, many of which got processed literally during the final 10 days leading up to the election. I think all of those things contributed to an environment that left poll workers trying to flip through a lot of manual paper rosters, respond to a lot of information from voters on scene. I think given all that, I think things operated pretty successfully because, again, I don't think it's designed well, and we need to address that. I think that we did have some issues where voters had mixed messages about eligibility, who could vote in the election, where they could vote. And I think those are the things that got exaggerated on Election Day, and I think we did our best to try and address those. But I think at the end of the day, we have to step back from this election and look at what is it like from the voter perspective, because even if those are not systemic issues for the individual voter, many of these people, brand new voters, they were left with not the best feeling about the voting process, and we ought to do better on that.
You actually intervened on behalf of one voter, an actor named Jonathan Daniel Brown. He tweeted you that he had been told by a poll worker that he wasn't on the rolls and would have to cast a provisional ballot. And how did you fix that?
Well, it's interesting because I have found social media in a jurisdiction like LA County, where we have 4.8 million registered voters and voting is spread out at 4,500 different locations, social media actually really gives me the opportunity as a public official to interact with people on a one-on-one basis on Election Day. And this is just one example of somebody who ran into an issue at his polling place. It was no fault of his own. He was frustrated. I wanted to de-escalate that situation because we have volunteer poll workers who are working hard to serve us. I was able to verify his eligibility here on our system. We were not able to identify in real time why they weren't finding him on the list, but I could verify that he was there. We knew who he was, and so I was able to get in touch with those poll workers and facilitate his ability to vote a regular ballot. And, I mean, I think that's ultimately what we're supposed to do. Obviously, can't do that in every instance, but that was a success in our.
So would you recommend that the next time someone is not on the rolls, that person should tweet you or at least call headquarters?
Well, certainly, as I said, in real time, on a real time basis, 4.8 million people, that's not going to be the ultimate solution for everybody. That is why we have provisional ballots and fail-safe methods to ensure that for whatever reason, if somebody's having an issue, that they're not turned away, that they're able to cast a ballot. I think, unfortunately, because we're at the end of the national primary scene, there was a lot of mixed messages about what a provisional ballot is, and many states have very restrictive laws about provisional voting. In California, provisional voting is actually a way to ensure that voters are enfranchised and that they aren't turned away from voting. So that would have been a successful option for that particular voter, but because he was concerned about that, given the messages going into the election, I thought it was important to de-escalate the situation and make sure he was able to vote.
Dean Logan, Los Angeles County Clerk, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to hear from you. Did you vote yesterday or Tuesday? How was your experience? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. One reason Bernie Sanders is pushing on till the July convention is wanting to shape the official Democratic Party platform. Every 4 years, both parties hash out what they stand for in their official platforms. They are essentially party manifestos. Both sides began work on their platforms this week, and here to talk about whether their work actually matters and whether politicians adhere to the platforms is Julia Azari, political science professor at Marquette University in Wisconsin. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What are the party platforms supposed to do? And do they matter, really, in the final analysis? Do the candidates adhere to them?
So party platforms are, in public statements, they're the way that the party tells the world what they're about and what their stances are. And it's true that one of the critiques of party platforms is that people don't read them. Recently, they've gotten quite long. And so that may be true, but I have this theory that I call the Devil Wears Prada theory of party platforms. So there's this scene in the movie The Devil Wears Prada where Meryl Streep's character tells Anne Hathaway's character that she may think she's above the fashion industry, but in fact the sweater that she's wearing is the product of all these fashion conversations that have been going on, and the line by Oscar de la Renta and all this kind of high-level fashion stuff, and then it manifests itself, she says, in the bargain bin where Anne Hathaway's character has bought her sweater. And I think there's kind of a similar process with platforms where they're very much inside the inside baseball kind of insider wonk documents. Interest group leaders do seem to read them and write about them. But ordinary citizens may not be thinking, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to really pore over the Democratic and Republican Party platforms. These documents are about 80 pages long now. But the stances that they encapsulate and that they express then become associated with what the parties stand for, and that trickles down into a larger political discussion. And so what goes on in a party platform discussion, what goes on within that committee of political elites, ultimately does become how we understand what the parties stand for, and then often the public policy debates and the policy itself.
But you have more and more people voting as independents.
Sort of. Party politics is...
Or identifying as independents.
Party politics is very important. And, you know, people call themselves independent. Most people who identify as independents, when you ask them, do you lean one party or the other? A lot of them lean, and they vote just like partisans. So, that you know, it's really party politics is what shapes the political discussion. And people who are more liberal, who are liberal on social issues, who think that there should be more social services, adhere to Democratic Party stances. And people who are more conservative adhere to Republican Party stances. So the idea that there are all these independent-minded people sitting down and, like, weighing out the issues and then going to the polls is not – it's an attractive idea, but it's not really true.
But the candidate who wins the nomination – is not obligated to abide by the party platform necessarily.
Not at all.
So why has it become such a big talking point in this election, at least on the Democratic side, with Bernie Sanders and his supporters wanting to have a big voice on the drafting of the platform?
So I think there's a bunch of different ways to answer that question, but one is about party priorities. So I think there's not a lot of questions in the Democratic Party about broadly where they stand on the issues. The Democratic Party, for example, has long been the party of raising the minimum wage, has long been the party that embraces stances that are more government intervention in the economy and worker protection. But specifically, one of the issues that is anticipated to be the central fight this summer is going to be the $15 an hour minimum wage. And so that will do a couple of things. That will signal that in this broader set of questions about the economy, that minimum wage will be the focus. That will be the way in which these broader broader policy commitments or ideas will be expressed through legislation about the minimum wage. And so that, you know, priorities matter a lot. If you think about how Obama's presidency unfolded, there's one major piece of legislation, and that's the one that he pursued quite early in his first term, the Affordable Care Act. If he had prioritized the environment or a more aggressive stimulus package or something along those lines, we would probably have a, you know, different set of public policies to live with and different politics. So one way that they do that is they show this priority, and then the platform fight will kind of illustrate how major principles will translate into concrete policy expression.
Well, do you expect, I'm looking at the platform as it exists now, and it's pretty vague, putting Americans back to work, the middle class bargain, cutting waste, reducing the deficit, economy built to last, et cetera, et cetera. Not something specific like we need a $15 minimum wage. Do you expect that this new platform will be more specific?
You know, I don't know. I don't think it's going to be drastically different than what we've seen. And you're absolutely right that the platforms are, you would not mistake the Republican platform for the Democratic one on most issues. But they're quite vague within that. And, you know, that reflects a lack of desire to commit to very specific kinds of promises about what policies they'll prioritize, or about things like we're going to fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage. I don't know that that is going to change in 2016 in a large way. But if you were to look at the platform and see places in which there was something specific like that, that kind of tells you that was a fight and somebody won. A lot of times with the platform, you do see this vague language that kind of tells you, well, there are all different people in the party that have different nuanced viewpoints about this issue, and they are all kind of in a stalemate. When you see a concrete statement like that that reflects some point of disagreement, that tells you that fight occurred and a resolution happened, and that's not a really common thing. So if that happens, it may be a couple lines in the platform, but it will be the product of a much more important process.
Well, it's interesting that this is something that normally we don't pay much attention to, but this year everyone seems to be interested.
Yeah, I think so. Although I will say the last couple of years, I've had this conversation the last couple of cycles, usually on the radio. What will the platform say? What are we paying attention to? What kinds of commitments will it make? And generally, it doesn't really matter. I think sometimes parties will try to use the platform to generate some excitement. The Republicans have had these online suggestion boxes where you can suggest things that should go in the platform. So that's one way that party platforms can matter and have mattered. But, you know, this time the reason it matters for the Democrats is because they've had this long nomination contest, and because one of the concessions that Sanders has been able to get is putting in quite an interesting group of people on the party platform committee, including Cornel West, who has been a pretty outspoken critic of the Obama administration.
Well, definitely. Yes, exactly. So that'll be interesting to see in July in Philadelphia what happens there. And I bet it'll get some media coverage.
I bet.
Julia Azari, political science professor at Marquette University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we want to hear from you. What would you like to see your party focus on or change? What would you like to see in the platform? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Shani Jardin is here to talk about Axl Rose trying to scrub unflattering images of him from the internet and other news from the web. That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Welcome to the jungle. What do Axl Rose and Barbara Streisand have in common?
Papa, can you hear me?
Well, besides their beautiful singing voices, they have both tried to scrub the web of stuff they don't like. And they've both failed miserably. We're going to talk about that and more news of the web with Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Maybe better than Axl Rose.
Axl Rose is having a bad week on the internet.
He is. So he's looking like he's 54 years old, as he is. And
he's no longer a sweet child of mine. He's a sweet middle-aged rock star of mine.
Maybe not so sweet.
Not so sweet, because he's sending these Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notices to a photographer and other people who are distributing unflattering images of him looking like he's gained a little weight. And it's become this meme. It's become this viral thing this week to mock Axl Rose not being a skinny rock star of the 80s anymore.
Oh, sweet Cheetos of mine.
So it's pretty, good stuff.
Yeah, but, you know, typical web juvenile stuff.
Yeah.
Why doesn't he just let it roll off him?
Good question. It's a great way for us to share with the listeners Why DMCA? Why those four letters get nerds so riled up? Because a star like Axl Rose, this is what he's doing, can sic his lawyers on the internet pranksters who are making fun of these photos and adding funny little captions and, you know, doodling drool coming out of his mouth or whatever. He can use this law, which was originally, the idea behind it was to protect the precious intellectual property of artists and giant movie studios and record labels on the web. But individuals and their high-paid attorneys can use it to squelch, you could say this is free speech. It's silly, but it's mocking a public figure. And this is part of American culture, that you get to, if not speak truth to power, make fun of it.
And the parody and satire and all that is time-honored tradition. Barbara Streisand had the same issue?
Yeah, so there's a phrase, the Streisand effect, that we use on the internet. So some years ago, according to internet lore, somebody was trying to publish some photos of Barbara Streisand's estate on the internet, and she sicked her lawyers on these people and said, no, you may not publish them online. And so different people, like concentric circles of people around the original uploader decided, well, screw this, we're going to publish these triple time. We're going to exponentially increase the number of people who can see this because she's a jerk for trying to silence this.
But so this, in that case, was this her privacy that she was claiming was being violated?
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of like the Hulk Hogan Gawker case.
Oof. Let's see. Well, there's no Axl Rose sex tape, and please, God almighty, don't let there be one. I don't want to see it.
Okay, let's move on. While Axel's going after the web, the FBI is going after one of the world's worst email spammers. This guy lives in San Diego, and he can send out...
What was the guy's name? Renault? It's like a French name.
Yeah, and he can send out a million obnoxious emails from his home in less than 15 minutes. First of all, how does he do that?
That's almost better than a 17-year-old. But they don't use email. It's like Snapchats, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, so this guy says that he is a prolific email marketer. The FBI and other law enforcement agencies say he is a spammer. And if somebody is choking your email server, you are the one who has to pay for that. You individually, but also the networks have to carry this load. The FBI released a statement saying something like it could cost a business $1 million a day.
But is it illegal?
Well, in this case, I believe they're going after the fact that the content was fraudulent, bogus stuff.
Okay. So it's not the actual sending of it. It's what was in it?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like getting Al Capone on taxes, right?
Yeah. So, but things that might be illegal or things that might be a scam, or it's just a way of...
He's closely associated with nothing good.
But is there a connection between this and the thing that we're talking about with Axl Rose, in that maybe we don't like what is being sent over the internet, but it's still, could it still be considered free speech?
It could. And I imagine that's what this emailer's attorneys will argue. And you could look at the content. You can say there is an argument to be made that this is on the wrong side of the law. But what about, you know, in the presidential campaign, right? Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, all of the candidates have... They push the boundaries of what's acceptable and sometimes what's legal in terms of promoting their campaigns. Those kinds of speech could also conceivably get caught up in this understandable desire to crack down on spam.
It does feel, though, that we get less spam these days. I don't feel like I get as much as I used to in my inbox.
You know, if you use a service like Gmail, it's a popular service. Google has all kinds of smart technology in place to help at least filter that to another folder. So there are lots of ways to avoid seeing it. But trust me, your server's still getting it.
Hmm. Okay, finally, Microsoft thinks it may be able to help diagnose cancer before your doctor can.
Yeah.
How?
This is an interesting thing. So Microsoft and various researchers were looking at the kinds of search queries that people made and tying that to medical diagnoses. So the thinking goes that if I'm Googling symptoms at home and there was some kind of AI or whatever, artificial intelligence, something like a Siri, but I, you know, like the Clippy, the paper clipped in Microsoft Word,
yeah,
remember that?
Yeah.
So Clippy could pop in and say, I see that you're searching for bloody blah symptom. you could have pancreatic cancer. You might want to get that checked out. It's a little grim, and it's sort of an odd thing to think about. But Google is actually has also conducted experiments like this, and there was some legal back and forth in the EU. There was actually a big backlash in the EU when the story came out that Google had partnered, I think it was with the NHS in the UK, to take artificial intelligence, you know, massive connected computer networks that can think in, to the extent that machines can think. What could you parse out of that data? What could a machine see in your queries that could tell you something useful? And as scary as all of that sounds, like Big Brother is looking at what you search so Big Brother can tell if maybe you have breast cancer, I think, like, Big Brother is already watching everything that you do online through ad trackers
mm-hmm.
and other kinds of trackers that we accept as normal because they're all about commerce. And the internet of today is all about commerce. So this kind of the surveillance, if you will, it's already happening. But what if the surveillance weren't about click-throughs on remnant ads? What if the surveillance was about helping you? And what if you had a say in who that data was available to, how it was used? Like, I don't want a hospital to be able to pop up an ad and say, we're really good at treating cancer. Looks from your searches like you have the possible symptoms of bloody blah cancer.
Or an insurance company saying,
no,
looks like your premiums are going to go up because you might have
yes, exactly.
this disease.
But what if there were some sort of neutral body that could look at that information, that could parse that information and return it to you in an ethical way? I think that is a pipe dream that has a snowball's chance in hell, but it's an interesting way to look at this problem.
Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, O.J. Simpson, a new 7.5-hour documentary, re-examines the trial and what led up to it.
The way that O.J. became palatable to white audiences and, you know, to Americans in general was to be deracialized.
We'll look at the O.J. trial with fresh eyes next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's all news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. On October 3rd, 1995, more than 95 million people gathered in front of their TVs or radios to learn O.J. Simpson's fate in what was dubbed the trial of the century. And when the verdict was announced,
we, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation.
The response on the streets in downtown Los Angeles was immediate. It was visceral. For a majority of Black Americans, the not guilty verdict was a sign of the criminal justice system working for one of their own. To a majority of white Americans, the verdict was evidence of the justice system breaking down. At the time, more than 70% of African Americans thought O.J. was innocent, while more than 70% of whites believed he was guilty. The question of why that is the subject of an upcoming 5-part series. It's called O.J. Made in America. It's a 7.5-hour saga that examines the epic rise and fall of a hero through the lens of race. Director Ezra Edelman is here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Let's begin at the beginning because you have a lot of information that I didn't know about, and that is basically O.J.'s early days. So he grew up as a poor young boy in San Francisco in the projects.
That's correct.
And when did he become the football star that he ended up being at USC? When was that apparent that he was something exceptional on the football field?
Well, I think he probably, to people around him, everyone always knew he was exceptional. I think he was naturally athletically gifted, as well as gifted, you know, period, as far as being that charming as well as handsome. I think the world, for instance, beyond his neighborhood really started to know him when he went to City College of San Francisco in 1965. You know, he was scoring touchdown after touchdown there. And that was, he was there for 2 years before he went to USC. And it's very interesting, and not to sort of get ahead of ourselves, but, you know, for me, looking at that period of time, which is the fall of 1965, what struck me personally was that all O.J. Simpson needed to do to become known to the world was carry a football. But concurrent to that, in Los Angeles, in Watts, you had a whole neighborhood of people who had to burn down their neighborhood, exploded in violence after this incident of police brutality to let the world know what they had been going through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that sort of juxtaposition right there that I sort of really saw from the get-go and made me want to tell a story on those two tracks.
Yeah. So he, in 1968, he wins the Heisman Trophy, right, mm-hmm. at USC.
Yes.
And 1968 is a year where this country is just torn apart. Martin Luther
yes.
King is killed and Bobby Kennedy is shot. Some people are talking about boycotting. Some black athletes are talking about boycotting the Olympics.
Black men and women athletes, professional and amateur, have unanimously voted to fully endorse and participate in a boycott of the World Olympic Games in 1968.
Athletics was becoming politicized, and O.J. Simpson declined to participate in that.
I've had a lot of pressure on me to go into politics. I was pulled into it once or twice in the black movement when I was in school. I think they tried to use this, and in many cases it hurt guys. I felt that with Harriet, it hurt Tommy Smith, it hurt John Carlos. Standing on his platform, I thought they should have been standing on their own platform. I said, if I stand on the platform, I'm going to be speaking for O.J.
He was going along doing his business, becoming a football star. You know, he didn't want to be inconvenienced by the politics of the time. And when Harry Edwards, who was a professor at San Jose State University and a noted activist, started something called the Olympic Project for Human Rights, in which he was trying to get black athletes to boycott the 68 games in Mexico City, he approached O.J. about being part of this movement. He really was trying to align black athletes with the civil rights movement, letting them know that they had a responsibility to become more political, to become more outspoken. And OJ's response was, I'm not black. I'm OJ.
But when you look at it, can you blame him? Here's a guy who grew up really poor, and here's his shot to make it and make it big. And he doesn't want to blow it. And he knows what he has to do.
I agree with you. I, for instance, am forgiving of OJ. You know, a lot of he's gotten, you know, not a bad rap, but he's gotten, you know, taken a lot of grief from people because of the choices he's made in his life. But at that point in time, when you're a 21-year-old kid and there are someone's approaching you and saying, you have to be this, you have to join the movement, you have to be outspoken. And OJ is basically saying, I'm seeing the way the public is responding to Muhammad Ali after he changed his name and refused induction to the draft to go to Vietnam. I see the way the white public is engaging him. And I'm interested in garnering love from everybody. And I'm interested in becoming this person that appeals to all Americans. And that's not the route for me. So for me personally, when you look at OJ at that time, I understand.
So he goes on to stardom with the Buffalo Bills. He becomes a spokesman for lots of companies, including most notably Hertz, where he makes those famous commercials where he's running through the airport.
Before you get there, your forms fill out, cars pre-assigned.
Go, OJ, go!
Rent a Ford Fast from Hertz, the superstar in rent-a-car.
Go, OJ, go!
Go, OJ, go! And a little old lady, some little kids. You have some very interesting interviews where you talk to the people who made that ad to say that they purposefully wanted to make him as unthreatening as possible.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You know, right after he left USC, he was in Chevrolet commercials and he was in RC Cola commercials. He was the first black athlete who was a corporate pitchman. He was a pioneer. He begat Michael Jordan and he begat Tiger Woods. And the way that OJ became palatable to white audiences and, you know, to Americans in general, was to be deracialized in many ways. And the fact that people were hip enough to that in the mid-70s, early 70s, to know that the best way to make O.J. palatable to American audiences is to remove all black people from the scene in which he's being shot. Frank Olson, who is the CAO of Hertz, said to us he was colorless. And, you know, it's very interesting because I understand what he's saying, but, like, OJ was black. So, you know, the idea that that's how he was seen, I don't know if that speaks to how charming and ingratiating OJ really was or some sort of weird way that those people needed to see him.
Hmm. And how did OJ see himself? He moves to a very white, wealthy neighborhood. He ends up marrying, as we know, a white woman. And he has white friends, Robert Kardashian, most notably. How did he see himself?
Well, I can't get inside the guy's head. I don't know. I think OJ thought of himself as black, and I don't think he ever forgot that. Wherever OJ got to be as he got older, again, this sense of I'm OJ in this OJ-ness, it did transcend race in his mind. What did it matter? He was still OJ. He's the juice.
Here's a clip of his friend Joe Bell saying pretty much that while they're playing tennis at the Kardashian house.
I said, man, the only reason we're here is we're jocks and you're OJ. And he looked at me. He says, yeah. He says, I understand what you're saying. And he rubbed his tennis racket. He says, but I am OJ. And ran off on the field laughing. And I was like, I mean, I was furious.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Ezra Edelman. He's the director of a new 5-part documentary. It's called OJ, Made in America. Let's get to the trial and get to the strategies. And it seems like there were two trials going on. And one was a trial for murder, and the other one was a trial of the Los Angeles Police Department. And we know which trial won in that case. You spent a couple of years interviewing the players involved, major and minor. And what did you come away with in terms of this trial and what you learned that was new?
You know, it's not so much that everything in this film is new or revelatory, but even I wasn't aware of the sort of all of the things that we cover in the film, these events that happened over the course of these 40 years in Los Angeles, these things that still that people still live with to this day. The shooting of Eula Love by the Los Angeles Police Department in 1979, the 39th and Dalton raid in 1988 when police came in and basically destroyed people's apartments in search of drugs and found very little, but destroyed people's homes. And so what I learned was, you know, how deep this history was. And that when we talk about the OJ trial and we talk about the context, very rarely do we get anything past one line about Rodney King. Johnny Cochran was brilliant in understanding that history and preying upon that history to a majority black jury. You know, but that's what this whole story is about.
Yeah.
And what makes this thing so weird is that, oh, right, by the way, there was a trial of a guy who, of a defendant who was on trial for murder, for brutally murdering two people. But the trial became about so many other things.
I want to play a clip of tape of Marcia Clark and one of the jurors that you interviewed. The prosecution thought that if they made this about domestic violence, about his history of domestic violence, OJ's history, that the jurors would understand. And that didn't go their way.
The domestic violence testimony was the why of it.
Let me tell you. I lose respect for any woman to take a ass whooping when she don't have to. Don't stay in the water if it's over your head. You'll drown.
They just didn't care.
Was that in fact the case?
Carrie Bass was the juror that was just on that clip.
Mm-hmm.
An older woman in L.A. who originally is from Missouri had a very sort of long history in terms of she picked cotton as a young girl in Missouri. And fled from a bad marriage to end up in L.A., you know, whereas Yolanda Crawford, who's in the film, was 22 years old at that time. And so if in the film within that same scene, she says, I definitely felt for Nicole, you know, and she actually listened to that evidence and clearly understood that, yeah, Nicole, I mean, OJ's a pretty bad guy, a very bad guy. But in her mind, that didn't mean that OJ murdered her. And that's where she sort of drew the line. And so I think it was very important to understand that, you know, here are two black women who they don't think alike And so people just can't reduce this to, oh, yeah, there was 8 black women in the jury and there's 9 black people overall. Of course they were going to acquit the black guy. It's not that simple.
Hmm. There was also a lot of contempt for the prosecution and its reliance upon shoddy police work. There's one moment in particular, the moment, the Perry Mason moment, where the glove doesn't fit. Hmm. And I thought what was interesting in your movie was seeing how Christopher Darden was convinced to have O.J. put on the gloves against the advice of Marcia Clark and everyone who thought this is too risky.
I went over to him and said, Chris, you know you're a good shit, but you've got the balls of a stud field mouse. That glove won't fit O.J., and if you don't show the jury that be the fact, I will.
Chris says, I want to do it. And I told him in no uncertain terms why we should not be doing this. And he said, well, if we don't, they will. And I said, then let them. Let them. And we can show why it was a bullshit experiment. It was never going to work. Between the shrinkage and the latex, it's never going to fit him the same way. Don't do this. Don't do this.
Why did he decide to go through with it?
I mean, if you can get Chris Darden on the phone, I would love to hear it.
Did he refuse your request for an interview?
Yeah, he did. Chris, more than anyone else in the prosecution, was someone I hoped to sort of someone's story who I really hoped to tell, because I was primarily telling a story about race. And in many ways, his role in the trial represented the bizarro nature of this whole story, that, you know, O.J., the guy who lived in the white world and had been accused of some people of betraying his race, is all of a sudden being prosecuted by a black guy who has a history of coming from an all-black neighborhood and idolizing the Black Panthers, but he grew up to be a prosecutor trying to put cops away, and yet he's the one called a Tom during the trial. It's like, whoa, what happened? And that he arrived at this moment in the trial feeling that he had been sort of had his thunder stolen by Johnny Cochran. Like, this was his big moment. He wanted this big dramatic thing to happen, and he wanted to be the one responsible for it. And so I don't know what compelled him to make that decision. But what everyone seems to agree upon was that it was a gigantic mistake.
There's someone in your movie who says that this is really a trial. It was a referendum on where we were as Americans in the 1990s. Was it business as usual with the police, or had the civil rights movement fundamentally changed things in America? And I guess it's hard to answer this, but it made me wonder what would happen if this trial took place today. Do you think the outcome would be different?
Who knows how that would have played today? But I think the real tragedy is that this is a reflection of how little there has been, how little justice people have felt, that O.J. became this vessel in which people could invest all of this energy. And I think there is a huge tragedy in that. I would like to think that, you know, someone has written that this ends up feeling like this was this great civil rights victory. And maybe it is, in the sense that, look, here is a black guy that was on trial and he was rich and famous. And look, he played by the same rules as a lot of rich white guys, and he got off. And so that's progress. But from my standpoint, it just is just sad. And that is sort of where, you know, we as black people were forced to go with our energies in 1995.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure, and your documentary is amazing, so congratulations.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Ezra Edelman. He's director of the 5-part series O.J. Made in America. Part 1 airs this Saturday on ABC. Parts 2 through 5 will air on ESPN June 14th through 18th. Coming up on this show, as of today, you must be 21 years old to buy cigarettes in California. Why was it 18 years old in the first place? We're going to look at age limits, how they're set for vices, voting, and going to war. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Starting today here in California, you have to be 21 years old to buy cigarettes and other tobacco products, unless you're active duty military. Military personnel can still buy cigarettes at age 18. Those men and women can go to war after all. And if you're male, you have to register with a selective service on your 18th birthday. We all become adults when we turn 18, don't we? Well, it depends which benchmark we're looking at and which state we live in. And though we generally think of our 18th birthday as the day we transition to adulthood, that hasn't always been the case. Holly Brewer studies this. She's the Burke Professor of American History at the University of Maryland. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks.
Why 18? When did that become the age we become adults?
Well, first of all, I would say it isn't only or clearly 18 even now. There are many different ages, depending on what you want to look at, like, for example, the new smoking rule law for California and drinking laws across the country. But I would say it's a question of long period of historical compromises, but that it's especially shaped by the Enlightenment, which is something that happened a long time ago and we don't think very much about, but that profoundly shaped American culture.
And what happened then in the Enlightenment to make us think that, oh, there's this age when we become adults and it's 18? Because I'm guessing that it was younger earlier.
It was younger earlier. And some historians have speculated that it was because people just had shorter lifespans, so you might only live to be 40 and half your life was in by the age of 20, and so that it made sense to give people control over their property at, say, age 14, which was the norm, or to elect people to parliament at age 12 or 15, which often happened. But I would say my own work indicates that it was actually debates that we associate with democracy, with government based on the consent of the governed, that shifted our ideas about what consent meant and reason meant, and shifted also a lot of our common law understandings of competency.
So when we could have true informed consent.
Exactly. But in the 20th century, we've gone back and forth a bunch about exactly when that should happen. On the whole, I would say we've moved upwards in terms of considering, in terms of what we judge to be adulthood. And even in the last 20 years, a lot of states have raised the age of consent for sexual activities, for example. But in one crucial respect, which is the age to vote, which is, I think, where our sense of adulthood being 18 comes from, it was lowered in 1971 by the 26th Amendment.
From 21 to 18.
Mm-hmm.
And now some states and localities are thinking we should lower it even further to maybe 16.
Right. And I think that actually makes a lot of sense, because I think young people are much more informed than they used to be. I mean, in the 18th century, for example, when a lot of states set rules of 21, or actually even at that point it was sometimes 18, many people couldn't even read very much or knew much about the world. And that is, of course, a crucial element of being able to make an informed decision and to be able to vote. And since so many young people, and especially with access to the internet, have a lot of information, I think it does make sense that voting age could be moved a little bit earlier.
Let's talk about how this plays into war and going off to fight wars and the military in general, because, okay, so you can be drafted when you're 18 or go to war, go die for your country when you're 18. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to drink unless you're 21 if you're in the military, unless you're stationed overseas or unless you live within 50 miles from the Canadian or Mexican border. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of unlesses. And then you have the smoking thing that I referred to earlier, mm-hmm. that here in California, military personnel are exempted from the 21-year-old law for smoking. Why is it so different with the military?
Well, first of all, I should say that I guess you really need to understand why it's different everywhere else. I guess what I would start with, and that is there was a big push by Mothers Against Drunk Driving starting in the early 1980s and going for the next couple decades, trying to shift the drinking rules across the country, with the argument that a lot of accidents are caused by people between the ages of 18 and 21 who have been drinking. So they successfully got the federal government to withhold highway funds from states, which wouldn't change those norms. But the federal government didn't really change its own laws, which about people in the military, except just a little bit, because they felt very uncomfortable doing that, I think, for obvious reasons, strangely. Mm-hmm. But everywhere else it did change. So I think it's actually the emphasis should be on why it changed everywhere else and on the effect of Mothers Against Drunk Driving on national policy.
Mm. And then I guess the military thinks it's okay for its men and women to smoke.
Right.
Because maybe that helps blunt the trauma of war.
Well, and I also think that people who serve in the military, we are in many ways considering them to be adults. I mean, they're risking their lives for their country. They're making a decision to sign up for the military, which was their own decision, and we allow it to them. And so it seems pretty crazy not to allow them to do something like drinking or smoking under particular conditions, at least if, you know, they're able to make those much more fundamental decisions.
Holly Brewer is the author of By Birth or Consent, Children, Law, and the Anglo-American Revolution in Authority. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
The oh-so-mature Jilly Myers joins us now. You're 18,
well,
right?
Over the age of 18. So today we talked to the LA County Voter Registrar, talking about provisional ballots and why people were frustrated for having to cast provisional ballots instead of just being able to vote regularly at their polling places. And Alex called in and made an interesting point. He had to do the provisional ballot, and he was like, intellectually, I know that it still counts. I know it's still voting, but it introduces a certain amount of uncertainty to the entire process. And once it's out of my hands, I don't know where it goes. If we can find a way to avoid that, that would make a lot of people feel a little less disenfranchised next time around.
Like just voting right there on a computer and having it count immediately.
Radical idea, Madeline.
Oh, yeah, you do that at your voting place. Okay. Jilly Myers, thank you very much. And if you want to weigh in, Twitter at KCRW, press play. Also on Facebook, same thing. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.